KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
These women knew that they were going to be not paid, but dragged, disbelieved, doxed in some instances, having their private address and phone number made public. All of these things have happened.
Activist filmmaker Dream Hampton had her doubts about making Surviving R. Kelly for the often soapy Lifetime channel, but she was convinced by a promise that she could keep the focus on women who came forward with horrific tales of abuse at the hands of the R&B star. She tells us about interviewing those alleged victims with lawyers watching her every move, and about the risks and rewards of making the docuseries, which has broken ratings records for Lifetime and had swift career repercussions for Kelly. But first on the News Banter, Woody says, you can't dump me just because I'm toxic. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my companion in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So Amazon, which we just talked about spending lots and lots of money, millions and millions on movies at Sundance, raising eyebrows. And this is under the new leadership of Jen Salke, who, as I think we previously pointed out, comes from a TV background. But we're not talking about her today. We're talking about her predecessor, Roy Price. You will recall very well, Matt, that Roy Price is no longer the head of Amazon Studios because of stories that we published about his alleged misconduct. But before he left, the reputation he had was as a guy who had a huge crush on certain kinds of auteur filmmakers, one of whom was Woody Allen. And I think people who worked at Amazon were astounded when he went out to a meal with Woody Allen and just delivered to Woody Allen this astoundingly rich deal, which produced Crisis in Six Scenes, I think not watched at all TV series, as also for four movies. It was shocking then, and it has become a bigger problem now.
Yeah, I mean, Woody Allen just sued Amazon, claiming that Amazon is trying to get out of the deal, essentially claiming that Woody Allen has become toxic and people won't work with him. We can only speculate as to what Amazon actually argued, because the lawsuit says that he got a termination letter, which just essentially says that Amazon is terminating the deal. And this is very interesting because it's a $68 million claim, and it brings into question what studios can do if someone has become radioactive due to the Me Too movement. Because Woody Allen argues that these are 25-year-old claims that have been made against him, most notably by his daughter Dylan, claiming sexual abuse when she was a child. And that was resurfaced by Ronan Farrow, who wrote a piece for The Hollywood Reporter a few years ago. And now in the Me Too movement, many stars have refused to work with him. People who filmed a movie with him that has not been released by Amazon because these stars will not do promotion. That all brings into question whether Amazon can say, you know what, you are so radioactive, we can't work with you anymore, so we're terminating the deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's very tricky when someone has not been convicted of anything. You know, Woody Allen, some people still argue about whether there's enough to say that Woody Allen deserves this fate or not, but there's certainly a perception that is sufficient that people do not want to be on a red carpet or work with Woody Allen. And you, our guest today, you know, we're talking about Surviving R. Kelly, and if you watch that series, people over and over again in defending R. Kelly say he was not convicted of a crime. He was tried and acquitted. Now, in retrospect, that looks to many people like a gross miscarriage of justice and an injustice. But that has given cover to a lot of people to go to his concerts and support his music. And his record label has only recently dropped him. And, you know, we know of other rumblings in this community about people who have a reputation and maybe their studios or production companies trying to get out of deals with them quietly. But again, it's really hard to do when there's nothing that you can say that person has been convicted of.
And I've heard people inside Amazon say, well, this was just an insane deal. Roy Price should never have made this deal with an 80-year-old filmmaker with this kind of past. But if that's the standard, that this was just a bad deal, then I think half the studio executives around Hollywood would be on trial, because studios make bad deals with talent all the time. People get hot, they get cold, they have scandals, they have, you know, misfires. And look at some of the deals Netflix is doing. They are equally, if not more, insane. And you want that that press release. Amazon wanted to say they were in business with Woody Allen, one of the greatest auteurs of all time. So now to come back and say, well, you've just become too radioactive, we do not want to work with you anymore. A contract is kind of a contract, and you have to have a legitimate reason for terminating it.
Yeah, I don't know if nobody will work with you as that. But, well, you know, another one, just to raise another example, Bryan Singer, I don't know what his deal with Millennium Films says, but right now we wonder who would be on red carpet with Bryan Singer, the director of Bohemian Rhapsody, very profitable, but we know that there were some very serious allegations against him in an Atlantic article. So it's the same situation. It arises, and the studios are going to have to figure out if they just have to pay up or there's a way to get out of these things for, I don't know, scorched reputational earth.
The difference in the Bryan Singer thing is the studio executive, Avi Lerner, is actually doubling down on Bryan Singer and defending him and saying, absolutely, he's never been convicted of a crime. And Amazon, obviously a much different company, you know, publicly traded and have a corporate ethos to it, is saying, no, this is enough. We're not doing this.
Meanwhile, I'll pivot to the, we think about to close Disney acquisition of Fox. This is a very strange and, for some people, not fun at all time. The $71.3 billion merger is going to lead to maybe 4,000 jobs vanishing.
Or more. I mean, some analysts believe it could be 5,000 to 10,000.
Yeah, that's staggering. And, you know, we had this article talking about the impact. People are sort of sitting there on the lot and there are empty parking spaces, and I blame no one for that. And just living in this anxiety, and this is a big bet, the biggest bet. I mean, Bob Iger has built up Disney with these huge acquisitions, Pixar and Marvel, and nobody is looking at those right now and saying, hey, was that a good idea? But this is really big. This is bigger by far. And digesting these things is a huge challenge. And even from pragmatic questions to who sits where physically, you know, you have Dana Walden, who's kind of got one office in Burbank and one office on the west side of LA, and people figuring out pragmatic stuff like that to, you know, who's going to be in charge of what? And is there going to be a kind of a roller derby within Disney because new executives have arrived and they're going to be jostling with Iger constantly claiming he's going to retire and not retiring. So we're looking at, this is going to be like a case study of a huge deal that I can't remember something that compares with this of one studio buying another on this scale.
No, there's nothing in the modern era. People at Fox are calling it D-Day, as in Disney. And I think this integration of Fox and Disney is going to be one of the biggest issues in Hollywood over the next 5 years or so.
Yes, we'll be watching it closely. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Chicago Sun-Times journalists Jim DeRogatis and Abdin Palesh first wrote about R. Kelly's alleged sexual pursuit of underage girls in December 2000. Yet for years, the singer faced no significant consequences. Kelly faced 21 counts of child pornography after a video leak that allegedly showed him engaging in shocking conduct with a 14-year-old. But after Kelly's lawyers delayed a trial for years, he was acquitted. Yet so open a secret were the allegations against Kelly that his rumored abuses were fodder for South Park and The Chappelle Show. In 2017, DeRogatis returned with another bombshell expose in BuzzFeed about Kelly allegedly holding multiple girls in a kind of sex cult in his Atlanta mansion. That sparked the six-part Lifetime docuseries Surviving R. Kelly, which finally prompted stars, including Lady Gaga, to denounce the singer. He was also dropped by Sony's RCA Records. The Lifetime series tracks years of allegations against Kelly using first-person accounts from many of his alleged victims and from people who have known and worked with him. Lisa Van Allen describes meeting R. Kelly on a video shoot in the late 90s when she was 17 and he was 31. Like many others, she was initially flattered by his attention, but when she moved into his house, she says Kelly became more and more controlling.
One time, one of his friends came to the studio and he's speaking to everyone and just a normal reaction, you speak back. Rob would get upset and say, you're not supposed to speak to them. You don't speak to anybody. You just look straight forward. If they speak to you, you don't say anything.
The alleged abuse escalated from there, with victims claiming they were beaten, deprived of food, told they couldn't even use the bathroom without permission. Making Surviving R. Kelly was obviously a fraught proposition that elicited threats, both legal and physical. Our guest today, Dream Hampton, is the executive producer and showrunner of the series. I'll start with a disclaimer, which is that R. Kelly denies being a monster.
Of course, we use that same disclaimer.
Yes, I saw that
a million times. Every commercial break.
He denies being a monster, and your docuseries has a lot of testimony to the effect that he actually is a monster. So we'll nod at his denial. So you came into this, you were approached by Boone & Murray, which is a reality company, and your reaction was more or less, what? Boone & Murray? No. But you, these two execs there, Jesse Daniels and Tamara Simmons, had a vision for this thing.
They did. I was approached by Jesse Daniels, who works with Joel Carsberg at Creative, which is housed in Boone & Murray. And they wanted to have a meeting with me. My agent said, Boone & Murray wants to talk to me. And I was like, about what? And I took that meeting on a Skype call, even though I'm in Santa Monica and they're in Burbank.
You're like, I'm not driving to Burbank for this.
But I started taking it really seriously when they told me that this was actually a different approach for them, that they were trying to do a more serious docuseries and that Lifetime had signed off for that approach. And then they said that they planned, well, I'm sure I asked, are we going to be centering the women who've survived him, who were his victims.
They'd already made contact with parents and victims. So
Jesse and Tamara Simmons, who's based in Atlanta, yes, they'd made contact with these girls. And they brought me on a showrunner, an EP, and we got started in February of 2018.
So who did you have coming in? How many of the women and how many of the parents?
We had both sets of parents, the Clarys and the Savages. And we had about a half dozen girls.
And so I've read that no one was paid to do this.
Not for their appearances.
Right.
I mean, we flew them out. We put them in a very modest hotel.
Right, that's standard stuff.
If someone had throwback pictures, we were able to give them a materials fee of a couple of hundred dollars, like you would a standard clearance.
But no one was paid.
Yeah. We also did hair and makeup.
Well, of course. You've got to do the hair and makeup.
So they knew they weren't going to get paid, and they still did it, which makes them my heroes, because we had many more women who wouldn't come on camera, who were available to corroborate the stories that we had, because this was a show where we were 200% sure that there was the threat of a lawsuit. And so in every interview that I did with any of the survivors, as we approached the survivors to pre-interview them, legal was present. Legal vetted our questions. So there are times when, you know, as a Black woman talking to these Black women who were traumatized, quite frankly, often, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I couldn't be my empathetic self. I felt like I was deposing them sometimes because my follow-up questions had to meet these legal standards. So it was an interesting process.
Are they literally standing there, these lawyers, in the room while they're on camera?
In the control room.
And are they speaking to you in your ear?
Yeah.
Which is difficult.
I'd never done that before. I hated it.
I can imagine.
So was the exec from Lifetime, Bree Miranda Bryant, who was very hands-on with this project. So.
I mean, we do these stories for print.
Yeah.
And then we deal with legal, but they're not generally on the phone with people that we're talking to who are accusers. I don't know. I mean, when I'm doing these stories, you know, the women are conflicted, very, very conflicted. They want to tell the story. They're afraid.
Yeah. And there's an additional shame, you know, when it comes to Black women, particularly when the law is involved, right? But even the court of public opinion, we know that this system is unjust to Black men, often unfairly targets them and treats them unfairly. Right. At the same time, sexual violence survivors aren't treated fairly in the system, regardless of race. And then when it's someone who has goodwill, when it's someone who has currency amongst their community, then you can anticipate a blowback. So these women knew that they were going to be not paid, but dragged, disbelieved, doxxed in some instances, having their private address and phone number made public. All of these things have happened to the women who, as soon as they came forward, by the way, to Jim DeRogatis,
the journalist from the Chicago Sun-Times. I will note, just because I can't help it, that Jim DeRogatis is not involved with this film.
Yeah, he's not. No, and I mean, this is a show about the business, so you won't be surprised to learn that he had another deal. He and Lyric Cabral, a wonderful independent filmmaker, they are doing a project for Hulu. I didn't get to talk to Jim until after the project was done. We started talking.
You didn't even have a conversation.
In late December. No, I was told by Buna Murray as soon as I came on that he was a hard no and that there had been some, you know.
That's kind of a little bit of a bummer.
Well, there was so much text. I mean, he'd given us a foundation from which to build.
He did such critical work.
Yeah, his 2 decades of reporting were absolutely the foundation. So he's included in the doc in that he's referenced and that we use still images of him. There was no way to make this without honoring his work.
Of course, yeah. You know, I had read this recent piece about him in the New York Times. Jim DeRogatis said he had somebody had shot a bullet through his living room window.
I'm profiled in that piece, too. It's a profile of he and I, and they talk about the fact that I've had security at my house from midnight to 7 a.m. So, yeah.
Is that something ongoing now?
Yeah.
Have you had any threat?
I mean, I don't want to talk about it, but we've had to have security. And then there was just the general backlash that I've been getting.
The fans, the
deranged the fans. It's multiplied again when it comes to, you know, my own community, Black folks who feel like this is more than an attack on R. Kelly, but it's an attack on all Black men.
It feels like a betrayal of the family in a way.
And I don't feel that way. I think that Black women and girls are a part of that family and that they should be centered and honored and protected and uplifted and believed.
I don't know if you started to feel from the get-go whether you and Lifetime sat down and said, look, this guy could be dangerous, allegedly, or did it become a thing as you went along?
I always took it very seriously. I don't know that the rest of the people on the team did. And I talked to them about being at war with R. Kelly. That's how seriously I took it. And then when we had a screening in New York with the survivors there, with Lifetime there. I happened to be in Johannesburg at the time. But when we had that screening and someone called in a gun threat and the NYPD stormed in and ended that screening, I think that people began to understand just how serious this was. I'm from Detroit. Chicago's next door. They don't have the same rules necessarily as New York and LA. There's not this like, oh, this is just another publicity problem, snafu that I have to power through. No, there's real life repercussions. So,
well, and it is an existential threat to R. Kelly in terms of, you know, his label has dropped him. People like Lady Gaga have come out and said that they're going to expunge songs that they did with him.
And that's what I hope for. I mean, I'm also an activist, so I'm not one of those documentarians who can say, I was just trying to tell a story. I'd hope for these outcomes. I became political during the South African anti-apartheid activism. And I was taught that boycott, divestment, and sanction was a real and effective and nonviolent way to affect change. And he is someone who was, to me, like a perfect target to experience that kind, since he was able to evade any kind of punishment in the legal system. If he were able to manipulate that system, which he did, you know, by dragging that trial on for 6 years, for keeping the victim close to him the entire time, paying off family members, which all of those things he did. The judge also wouldn't allow certain evidence about his pattern in there or other settlements that
The pattern of conduct that was so important in bringing Bill Cosby to justice.
Right. This judge in Chicago didn't allow it. So for all of those reasons, he didn't experience any justice at the hands of our legal system.
You have a juror in the...
Yeah.
And it's a horrifying moment.
I just didn't believe them, the woman. I know it sounds ridiculous. The way they dress, the way they act, I didn't like them. I disregarded all what they said.
He didn't like the way they looked. He didn't like the way they talked. He didn't like the way they dressed. Mm-hmm. Something that all women basically have to face when they go in to this system to talk about being survivors of sexual or gender violence. And then again, it's multiplied when you're a Black woman facing a Romanian immigrant who stands between you and justice.
Coming up after a short break, Dream Hampton tells us who refused to be interviewed for surviving R. Kelly. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW Donation Car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Dream Hampton about the Lifetime docuseries Surviving R. Kelly. Lifetime will re-air part of the six-part series on February 25th. Through on-camera interviews with nearly 50 people, including alleged victims, music journalists, record industry veterans, former R. Kelly employees, and even the singer's own siblings, Surviving R. Kelly details decades worth of allegations that have dogged the singer even as his career continued to flourish. At the center of the series are the accounts of Kelly's alleged victims, women who tell of being lured into Kelly's world, picked up at a high school or a mall or a concert, or in the case of one victim, in the crowd at the singer's own child pornography trial. Once under Kelly's roof, they say they were forced to follow strict rules, starved, beaten, and cut off from their families. Speaking on camera, Kitty Jones, Geronda Pace, Asante McGee, Lisa Van Allen, and Lizette Martinez say coming forward was something they felt compelled to do.
I felt like my silence allowed it to continue. I worked up the courage to come forward and tell my story. A part of me always felt like maybe I did something for him to treat me that way.
I want my story to be heard so people could take this situation seriously.
But when I found out it wasn't just me,
I just don't want it to get any worse.
And it just kept going and going and going.
I just wanted to know that it's not, you know, you're not alone.
You just got this snowballing number of victims.
Yeah. That was something that Bree Bryant at Lifetime kept calling us and saying, we need more. We need more. And, you know, I got really frustrated. I was like, they all have the same story. We have plenty that won't come on camera that are cooperating. She said, no, we need more on camera. And so sometimes we were literally on Spokio, like looking, we'd heard a name and we were cold calling them, which was, you know, really hard for them more than us. But yeah.
Because they were like, I imagine in the first, at the beginning, a lot of them were like, there's no way I'm doing this.
Exactly. I mean, they'd seen him already be acquitted. So there wasn't much hope that this would change anything. Like I said, we got a lot more no's than yeses. He's been doing this for 3 decades. So there are lots of women who've been victimized by R. Kelly.
So at that point, it morphed from being, what was it supposed to be, 90 minutes or something? I can't remember the original plan.
Yeah, when I came on, it was definitely a two-hour project. And then, by the time we wrapped, it was six.
And did you feel like, I see what you're saying, Bree, more is better? Or were you like, at a certain point, because in the beginning, you were like, it's the same story.
Oh, no, I pushed back to the end. But she was right. I probably would have made it a 4-hour series because I didn't want to do the biopic on him. I didn't want to do his behind the music. But then I see that she was right around that, too, to do this. I didn't want to do a linear timeline. I wanted time to kind of fold in on itself in places. But she wanted a very linear timeline that started in the 70s when he was a child being abused himself. And she was probably right about that. I don't know what I was thinking. It's Lifetime.
Artistic.
We just laid it out. It was fine. Yeah. In the end, I mean, what I forget when we hear things like, oh, Lauryn Hill's album is 25 years old or the Biggie album came out 25 years ago, is that there's a whole generation that doesn't even know about this period, you know, that this was their first time having all of these facts laid out for them. And so that ended up being important.
You mean the period when there was a trial and that
the
sort
period
of thing.
When the tape came out of him abusing the 14-year-old.
Right.
Again, that was something pre-internet, but it went viral on the streets in a certain way.
Yes, that was definitely pre-internet virality. You have, you know, in Shadows, someone who was on the staff. Obviously, we don't want to reveal anything about what a source's identity would be, but how does that person come to you and say yes?
A lot of negotiating. I mean, a lot more people on his team said no, but we talked to them too to cooperate again. I wanted to talk to Regina Daniels, who was his publicist for many years. She stopped working and being friends with R. Kelly when he slept with her daughter. Hmm. I wanted to talk to her. I wanted to talk to Barry Weiss at Jive Records, who continued to promote his music even after that tape came out. I wanted to talk to a couple of women at his label, quite frankly, at Jive Records, who I knew were very close to him. And they both talked to me on the phone, but wouldn't come on camera.
You did get John Legend, which I you know, you sort of love him when you see him just talking. And he said subsequently, it was no big deal. I just said what I believe. But others didn't want to. Other musicians.
Yeah. John Legend, who I'd worked with around some prison reform stuff, was a quick yes. It's true. And he brought himself out to Burbank and he sat for 2 hours for me. He's also only in a 6-hour docuseries, about 4 minutes and 30 seconds. So I didn't want this to be a piece about celebs talking about R. Kelly anyway. So even if Gaga had said yes, I would have needed her for about 45 seconds to tell us, you know, how she...
You did ask her.
Yeah. Well, how do you reconcile doing this SNL performance as someone who advocates for DV victims? I definitely want to ask Erykah Badu what the heck she meant at the Soul Train Awards when she said that no one has done more for Black people than R. Kelly.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I'm like, I can think of a zillion.
More four or more two is the question.
You know, she tried to deny that she was invited. She was invited. She talked to the producer.
Invited to be in the series.
She was. Mm-hmm. She was a non-reply. So she maybe she read that she had refused and took umbrage with some, you know, the technicality of whether or not she non-replied or refused. But I just wanted to ask her about that Soul Train Awards when she was hosting and called him that. She then went on to talk about praying for him. She didn't say she was praying for any of the victims, who all have names. And she didn't mention any of them from the stage in Chicago. And she got booed. And she's then went on to, you know, say that somehow she's in a different spiritual plane than the rest of us. She's evolved and has unconditional love for people. And and I don't know, we're just the mob.
Yeah, so, the mob. Did you feel that in the rough gauge of Twitter, you had support more so than not?
I mean, I experienced everything on Twitter. I mean, the first two nights, everything was going smoothly. Then when Charlamagne, See the God, a radio personality in New York, comes on screen, we'd cut him significantly after we learned, after my interview with him, that he himself had been accused of raping someone in his hometown in North Carolina 15 years ago. So it was a hard call. It was ultimately mine to make. And I did say, let's still include him and cut him down a lot. And I took the blowback for that. I shouldn't have done it. I should have included him. And I deserve that dragging. Then Teray, someone who I've known for decades, a music journalist who is also in the piece, started doing publicity around the project. And someone then accused him and started producing screenshots of him sexually harassing her, or having described that sexual harassment in the screenshots where he apologized. So there are a couple, three things in my estimation that have allowed this to go on so long for R. Kelly. One of them is the whataboutism. The other thing is this, I don't want to be involved, which is what we saw with celebs and people who worked, more importantly, at his record industry, people who enabled his predation. And then the third thing is this idea that people who accuse you have to be perfect, people who are your detractors, and I'm one of them, and See the God and Teray are detractors, have to themselves have never harmed. And that can't be the bar. It just can't be. We can't demand that the accusers be these perfect people when you're talking about someone who's behaved so monstrously for so long.
You know, he's been dropped by his label. There are some investigations underway. Mm-hmm. What would you hope would happen?
I hope that there is a case, actually. I mean, I hope for the Clarys. Azriel Clary, who's still with him right now in early 2019, was 17 when she was disappeared from her family by R. Kelly. And in the state of Florida, where she was when he met her and first had sex with her, that was rape. So they have gone to the police. They've gone to the FBI. And there isn't some secret wing of the police waiting to drop out of the ceiling to rescue Black girls.
I have to say, the question I had watching, and as a parent myself too, is like, how is this guy honestly alive? How is no mother or brother or father just... I mean, one of the moms talks about coming for him.
Yeah. I mean, he has security. He's not your average predator. You know? I mean, he's a 52-year-old R&B singer at this point, so his money is dwindling. But for all of these decades, he's had security.
Not so easy to get at.
Not easy to get to, yeah.
Filmmaker Dream Hampton is the executive producer of the Lifetime documentary series Surviving R. Kelly. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Kim.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith and Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.